So, as I mentioned a moment ago, we're in Luke chapter 14 this morning, starting in verse 25. Luke's the only one who gives us this information, so I won't be comparing other Gospels this morning. And if you don't have the harmony, not particularly necessary, as he is the only writer giving us this information. So we'll be in Luke chapter 14, verse 25. As you see there at the bottom of 153, great multitudes were going along with him. He turned and he said to them. So this is not a private conversation with the disciples or even the smaller group of the 12, but large groups of people. And Jesus is saying in 26, if anyone comes to me and does not hate his own father and mother and wife and children and brothers and sisters, yes, and even his own life, he cannot be my disciple. Whoever does not carry his own cross and come after me cannot be my disciple. Now, I'm sure scanning the audience this morning, there's none among us who struggles with that word hate, although many have. It's a colloquial expression of the time. It has to do with simply recognizing priorities. Not that we are to turn against our family, for the scriptures are just full of the admonitions that we are to love them, that we are to serve them, that love, of course, is the grand goal of all Christian doctrine and certainly of the Lord's teachings here at this time. But by way of comparison, the love that we should have for him should just transcend all things to such an extent that if you compare the love you have for your parents or your children or your husband or your wife with the love that you have for the Lord, then hopefully, as Jesus teaches right here, you'll come to appreciate that your children and your parents and your spouse have never and could never and will never do for you what God has done for you. Our appreciation then, what we have in a kind and loving and compassionate God who serves us in so many different ways ought to be just immense and eclipse that, even of these natural affections that we have here on this earth. Now, we're going to be moving very rapidly this morning because we're just a page or two behind the pace here. But when we have pages like this of singular material in the Gospels, that's what tends to bog the pace down. And so on the average, you need to cover five pages, but if you look at the next couple of pages, that's a lot of material. And so, again, as I scan the audience, and I think even just in America in general, these are passages that are familiar. They are passages that we understand because they're really pretty straightforward. The intervening verses in 28 through 32 just simply say to count the cost. And that's what Jesus just said about our love for him and for our God in verses 26 and 27. So we're going to do a little more of that kind of skipping here this morning than we have been doing. And we want to come down to verse 33 in Luke 14. So therefore, no one of you can be my disciple who does not give up all his own possessions. Therefore, salt is good. But if even salt has become tasteless, with what will it be seasoned? It's useless, either for the soil or for the manure piles thrown out. He who has an ear to hear, let him hear. Well, of course, they're back to the Sermon on the Mount, which we discussed quite a long time ago. Jesus has already used this illustration of salt, of the value that there is in salt. And is pointing out, obviously, if your salt isn't salty, you don't salt your salt. You just look for some other salt. And we're the salt of the earth. The Jews of Jesus' day, as Jews under the law, were the salt of the earth. They were supposed to be manifesting a moral standard that was far above, all the rest of the world. They were supposed to be a light to the world. And certainly, as Christians, after the fulfillment of all that Old Testament, we are as well. And so salt's good, and you're the salt. But if you don't have that influence, if you don't change the taste of the world that you're in, if you're not actually impacting and affecting the flavor of the circumstances around you on a daily basis, well then, you're fit for the manure pile, but not much else. And so Jesus can be, in illustrations like this, that at least is eye-opening and attention-catching for those who want to serve him, as he so often has been, as we've been studying, for those that are rejecting him. That's a pretty powerful image, you know. And so hopefully it slaps us, you know, on both cheeks, and it causes us to want to say, well, okay, you know, that's right. I need to keep remembering this, that I'm supposed to be a change agent. It's a term we used to use in days gone by. We're supposed to be people who make things happen. We're supposed to be a people so that when somebody comes into contact with you, they remember you. Now, maybe I'll brag just a little bit, but, you know, because I broke my record, brother. And I've been forgetting to tell you now for over a month. Anybody remember these? DVDs, what must I do to be saved? Put my, you know, contact information on the back. We had quite a bit of interest in those. You know, we're passing those out. We bought a couple of hundred of them already. But, you know, really want to keep those going. And my all-time record, as I tried to be the salt of the earth, was 3 in a day. And I just was embarrassed by that. It's terrible. You know, I meet more than 3 people in a day. So I kept telling myself, 10, I'm going to go for 10. Somebody I'm going to do 10. I did 18. You know how I did it? I went into the post office carrying a load of packages 2 days before Christmas and got in line with 40 other people. And it took me 40 minutes to get to the front. But when I got out of my car with those parcels, I took my whole stack of DVDs. And when I got done up at the counter, I turned around and I said, Merry Christmas, to the woman behind me as she was approaching the counter, and I gave her one. And I went to the next one and the next one and the next one. By the time I got to the door, I had been down the whole line and I didn't have any more DVDs. So I said to that last girl, you're out of luck. She said, story of my life. But the whole office was looking at what? Salt and light. So I don't know what they did with it. And I don't know that I've handed out another one since then. You know, you like to camp. Brethren, we're the salt of the earth. So what should we be doing? Salting the earth. You don't know how the seed grows, the Lord said in another parable. Farmer doesn't know how that seed, you know, works down there under the soil. But you plant, you plant, you plant, you plant. So those discs may find their way to who knows what into the trash can discovered by, you know, the garbage man. But you plant the seeds everywhere you go. So we are taught here to keep redoubling our efforts. Just be after it. Every single day, all the time. Doesn't matter that you see the results. It matters only that you stick the little seed down there in the soil. So we come now, ending that chapter, to Luke in chapter 15. You look at only just a couple of verses here. You know, I keep breathing on this thing. See if I can put a little higher maybe and get over the top of it. But look at Luke 15 in these first 3 verses. Now, all the tax gatherers and the sinners were coming near him to listen to him, and both the Pharisees and the scribes began to grumble, saying, this man receives sinners and eats with them. And he told them this parable. What man among you, if he has 100 sheep, and... Now, is there anybody in America who does not know this story? It's called... the 99, you know, or the parable of the lost sheep. And it's only the first of 3 in chapter 15. So we're going to get a parable of the lost coin. We're going to get a parable of the lost son. What it's about is the value of that which is lost and the commitment and the dedication and the effort that is the responsibility and would be, hopefully, flowing out of love and not a sense of duty to go seek and to save the lost. Well, really, brethren, what is this about? The salt. he has flowed from chapter 14 to chapter 15 without interruption. It's the same great multitude right there. It's just that the Pharisees and sinners are listening to what we've just been reading, and it makes them mad. They just don't like anything Jesus does. But brother, you know these parables. Jesus then is choosing as the master teacher to four times in a single instance do what? Tell them the same thing. He's just saying the same thing over and over and over again. He does it with different illustrations, but it's the same thing over and over and over. You are to influence the world. You are the salt of the world. You're the shepherd that's going to go out and search the hills in the rainstorm, as they always paint, you know, the parable the artists do. You're the one that rejoices over the finding of the lost coin. You're the one, you know, that hopefully will be influential in calling the prodigal back and accepting them when they return. And so this 15th chapter is so well known, each and every one of those parables, because Jesus kept hammering on exactly the same thing, just using different illustrations. So we're going to skip all the way down to verse 18, 19, and 20. And in 18, I'll get up and go to my father, and I'll say to him, Father, I've sinned against heaven and in your sight, and I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me as one of your hired men. And he got up and came to his father, but while he was still a long way off, his father saw him, felt compassion for him, ran and embraced him and kissed him, and you know the story. And you also know that, because I've touched on this several times in the last few years, this has long just distressed me, I guess, that it's come to be called the story of the prodigal what? It's always called the story of the prodigal son. And sure, there's a story there about the son. So really, what is the story about? Who's the main actor? Who's the guy that does, you know, the talking? It's the father. This is the story of the prodigal's possessive father. It's about the behavior of the father. It's about a father who has the wisdom to let his son go suffer. It's about a father who has the wisdom to pay a high price, give the kid the inheritance, and let him go. It's about a father who does not send him meals on wheels to welcome him to the new town. He doesn't write him a support check. It's about the father who lets the kid learn his own lesson. But when the kid does learn it, unhappily the hard way, what's the father do? Then the father receives him. Whereupon immediately the older son, he's what? Well, he's jealous, and he's stingy, and I don't know how many other things we might accuse him of, you know, but it really bugs him. He has been faithful. He has done a better job. He has served his dad. And it ought to make you want to gripe. You know, I mean, really, when you see that kind of stuff, I did everything for you, Dad, you know, and look, you throw the party for him and not for me. So, you know, we know how that goes. The father is teaching lesson after lesson after lesson throughout this with different parties. First for himself, how do you handle a rebellious son? Secondly, for the son, you receive him right back. Then for the other son, now son, what else would you expect? You know, I love him. And so, verse 28, he became the son, the older boy, not willing to go in. His father came out, began to entreat him. So now he's begging, you know, for him. But in 31, he said to him, my child, you've always been with me. All that is mine is yours. We had to be merry and rejoice. This brother of yours was dead and has begun to live and was lost and has been found. Well, that's the point of all of those parables. So, when somebody messes up just as royally as they possibly can, and they're out there just being in the world as filthy as they can possibly be, what should you do? Well, brother, be like the world. Be salt. Don't be an enabler. Don't go send them checks so they can continue. They're going to have to learn the hard way. And it was with the father, you know, just leaving him to it. No, they weren't. But when they come back, then what? first, you wag the finger and you say, I told you so, right? I mean, first, then you receive your message. No. Oh, you're right, you kiss him, you kill the bad jab, have a party. See, none of this I told you so stuff, just pure joy. And if anybody complains about it, they're irked about it. And brethren, we read about it in 2 Corinthians. In 1 Corinthians, we got a chapter that spends much of its time about a guy committing a sin so disgusting that even people in the world would never do anything like that. Okay? But the guy repented once he had been cast out of that congregation. And in the second letter, Paul has to write to the Corinthian congregation and say, wagging his finger, receive him back, lest he be overborne with sorrow. Your job, take him back. Maybe he figured that out by reading Luke 15. That's the way you're supposed to do. So then we're going to come down now in Luke 16 to just verse 1, top of page 156. He was also saying to the disciples, this is a big, long event with maybe thousands of people, great multitude listening. There's a certain rich man who had a steward. His steward was reported to him as squandering his possessions. So the steward's going to have to give an account for what he did. And he decides that he's going to cheat his master even more. So he starts calling in the master's debtors. These people don't owe the steward money. They owe the master money. And he says, you just reduce your debt. So we'll cut this, you know, to 80. We'll cut this to 50. And you know, it amazes us that this man is so selfish. He just tried to cover himself so that when he gets fired, these people now will be indebted to him and take care of him. But in verse 8, his master praised the unrighteous steward because he had acted shrewdly. Brethren, smart is smart. And even when people do evil in cool ways, you got to tip the hat and say, well, how about that? You know, what was it? There's an old movie, and I haven't seen it in forever, but how many of you like Sean Connery? Okay. Donald Sutherland. Do you remember when they did this movie? It's clear back in the 70s, I think, about the great train robbery in England, what's come to be called the Great Train Robbery. And so they had a movie that was called Great Train Robbery with Sean Connery and Donald Sutherland. And they showed how elaborate those thieves had been in the design of their plans and how they had been able to rob a moving train and get away with it. That's cool. So he acted shrewdly. Did he act righteously? No. He's praised only for being shrewd. He's not praised for doing right. What the man did was wrong, but it certainly wasn't a genius. And uses that in verse 8, though, to point something out that is a fundamental fact in nature. It's a bit distressing, and it's shameful for God's people. But it is true in verse 8 that the sons of this age, that is to say, worldly people, are more shrewd in relation to their own kind than the sons of light are. So, sadly, people in the world really participate in being in the world. And they really support each other in it. They got a really dedicated bunch of souls there, don't they? Yep. Kind of embarrassing for us, isn't it? That's the lesson. So rise up, look, try to be as ingenious as the world is. Try to help each other like the world does. Try to participate, you know, to the best of your ability so that you get these good things done for your God in a righteous way, certainly not an evil way. So the lesson in 9 through 13, I say to you, make friends for yourselves by means of the mammon of unrighteousness, that when it fails, they may receive you into the eternal dwellings. Oh, a strange little lesson there, but what it is heaven is watching. So down here, while you're handling the things of this earth, as a steward taking care of the master's possessions, God's the master, His possession is you and everything else that you see around you. So, handle mammon, the things of the world, properly, and then ultimately it will fail. It has to fail. It's not enduring. That's its nature. It's going away. And when it does, you get to go away to heaven. Because you don't need this stuff. You never did. Use it well. Use it for the Master's good purposes. If therefore, verse 11, 10 rather, he who is faithful in a very little thing is faithful also in much. He who is unrighteous in a very little thing is unrighteous also in much. If therefore you've been faithful in the use of unrighteous mammon, who will entrust the true riches to you? And if you've not been faithful in the use of that which is another's, who will give you that which is your own? No servant can serve two masters. Either you'll hate the one and love the other, or you'll hold the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and mammon, and that's the lesson that Jesus teaches on more than one occasion. So once again, I think I just skip over this. You know how I love to talk about Luke 16:10. Brethren, the tiniest little thing you can think of in the service to your God is as important as the biggest thing that you can think of. Because if you're faithful in the little tiny nitpicky stuff, so come back to this theme in Matthew 23, then you'll be faithful in the big things too. But if you're unfaithful in the little stuff, if you're cutting corners at the little stuff, if you're not keeping the rules and obeying the laws in the world that belongs to God and not to you, if you can't play the game the way you're supposed to in that little stuff, then who's going to give you the true riches? Who's going to entrust something big and magnificent to you? So, brethren, you know, if a family has four kids and three cars, and the oldest kid comes of an age and gets his license, and then you can tell he's not taking care of dad's car. How likely is it that dad's going to want to go buy him a car? If you can't respect what belongs to the parents, why would you turn him loose with something of his own? You can't trust him. So, you got your car, you got your insurance, you know, you got yourself covered, you let the kid borrow it, but you don't want to say, here's the keys to your own car. Think of the damage this kid can do. And God's looking down from heaven, thinking the same thing. They give you heaven, if you can't even figure out how to handle the world, that has no value. That's not going to last. That's such a little thing. Like, why do you care, you know, about cutting corners on that? Take care of it. Turn it to the Master. Go home to heaven. You can't serve both. Nobody ever could. Now, we come to Luke 16:14 at the bottom of page 156. Verses 14 and 15, the Pharisees, who are lovers of money, are listening to all these things and are scoffing at him. Is that because they don't understand what he's saying? No, it's because they do understand what he's saying. So they're mocking him. They love the money. They know what he's doing. And he said to them, you are those who justify yourselves in the sight of, he says men, but let's just substitute world. Let's use the word mammon that he used earlier. You can't serve both, he just said. And we know who you've picked. God knows your hearts. That which is highly esteemed among men is detestable in the sight of God. Two different standards, two different sets of values, two different ways to measure success and failure. And success, as that shrewd world that supports the worldly and all that they do, you know, if that shrewd world is commending you for the way you're behaving, then something's gone wrong. We're supposed to be out of sorts with them, unfamiliar with the world, not appealing to the world. Everything that we do as saints, first and foremost, the value system that descends from heaven and not the one that is so often embraced, which is earthly and sensual and demonic, as James would describe all things that are in the world. So, Jesus is attacking, you know, those men, again, very directly, skipping to verse 19, there toward the top of page 157. There's a certain rich man, he habitually dressed in purple and fine linen, daily living in splendor every day. A certain poor man named Lazarus was laid in his gate, covered with sores, and you know that story, don't you? It will not end well for the rich man. Not going to end well for him at all. He'll be begging for mercy. He'll be begging for mercy for his brothers. He doesn't want anybody after death to be experiencing what he now is. So down to verse 28, I have five brothers. So send Lazarus to warn them, lest they also come to this place of torment. But Abraham said, they have Moses and the prophets. Let them hear them. But he said, no, Father Abraham, but if someone goes to them from the dead, they will repent. In other words, well, they won't listen to the prophets, but, you know, boy, if somebody came back from the dead, they sure respond to that. He said to him, if they do not listen to Moses and the prophets, neither will they be persuaded if someone rises from the dead. Now, brethren, chapter 14, 15, now 16. Jesus repeating lessons over and over and over again to the same audience in one sitting. And maybe we're going to start, you know, to get it here. There's the world, mammon. And then there's the spiritual world. We are entrusted with responsibilities like stewards, like shepherds, like the lady with the coin, like the father with the son. But what it all comes down to is preparing ourselves for a judgment that will be based not on how much money you have, not on how much power you have, not on how pretty or handsome or strong that you are, not talents that have anything to do with the world, but based on what? Moses and the prophets. So brethren, you've all watched it. Here in the United States of America, what has the gospel been diminished into by most denominational groups? It's been reduced to cheap self-help platitudes. Do they spend their time talking about what must I do to be saved, or here's how you can be a good husband or wife. Here's how you can raise your kids. Here's how you can make more money. Here's how you can, you know, fight for social justice. And so, you know, it's just awesome to watch how spirituality and doctrinal purity and the knowledge and the embrace and understanding and ready recollection and use of Moses and the prophets has just all but vanished from America. Brother, you all know this. Harvard, Yale, take these big colleges, not in the United States, but take these big colleges, for instance. Who started them, and what was the foundation for their whole reason for existence originally? They were religious schools. They were Bible-based schools. And what have they become? You go to Harvard to study the Bible? What do you go to Harvard for? Study the law. Whose laws? God's laws? Man's law. Be faithful with man's laws. You know, they'll teach. And what about God's? You know, nothing. And so, Jesus is saying, be faithful in that which is little. You'll be faithful in that which is much. Be unfaithful in that which is little, and you'll be equally unfaithful in that which is much. But Moses and the prophets is the source of all things. And if people won't believe that, then even if you threw a grave open, they won't believe. And by the way, what will Jesus do here in a matter of a few months? He will throw a grave open. And will they believe? No. No, they won't. So hopefully, you know, it'll sink deep into our ears here. Moses and the prophets, Moses and the prophets, to the law and the prophets, brethren, that's what matters. And of course, that's why you and I are here this morning. This is what we care about. So you didn't come in here this morning to try and figure out how to be a better parent. The world's got all kinds of information on that. The Bible's got some too, but not a whole lot. That's not the focus of the Bible. We're not here to learn how to make more money. We're not here to learn how to have a successful business. We're not here to get all those, you know, self-help deals. We're not here, brethren, to teach you how to overcome addiction. We're not here to get over all that stuff that most churches have become. We're not here to feed the world. We're not here to end poverty. We're not here for those things. What are we here for? Plant the seeds that will bear fruit to eternal life. Eternal life. And that's why the Bible has so little to say about all that self-help motivational stuff that most churches now spend all their time on. Not us. Never us. Not in our lifetime, brethren. Not in our age. Now, talking about opening graves, what's the John going to do? John chapter 11 on page 158. Now, it appears that these events are closely related. Though now it's not Luke anymore. It's not the next thing in Luke. It's John over in chapter 11. But Jesus was just talking about Moses and the prophets instead of raising people from the dead. And then, though, what did he prove? He didn't have the power to do it. Raise people from the dead. So in verse 3 of John 11, the sisters said to him, Lord, behold, he whom you love is sick. Jesus heard it. He said, this sickness is not unto death, but for the glory of God, that the Son of God may be glorified by it. Skip it down to 11, this he said, and after that he said to them, our friend Lazarus has fallen asleep, but I go that I may awaken him out of sleep. Disciples therefore said to him, Lord, if he's fallen asleep, he'll recover. Now Jesus had spoken of his death, but they thought he was speaking of literal sleep. Then Jesus therefore said to them plainly, Lazarus is dead, and I'm glad for your sakes that I was not there, so that you may believe. But let us go to him. Thomas, therefore, is called Didymus, said to his fellow disciples, let's also go that we may die with him. I always read that verse because, and again, I think in this audience, you'll know, Thomas gets a bad rap. What's the one thing you know him for? What's the doubting? You know, terrible. He's gone down through two millenniums with that appellation attached to his name. Does the Bible ever refer to him as Doubting Thomas? No. But it sure tells us right here, out of all the disciples, who was the one who apparently was really actually ready to get up and go die for the Lord if he had to? It was Thomas. So, let's go, that we may die with him. Skipping down to 21. Martha said to Jesus, Lord, if you'd been here, my brother would not have died. Even now I know whatever you ask of God, God will give you. And Jesus said, your brother will rise again. And Martha said, I know he'll rise again, but not today. The Old Testament's teaching and the common view of the Jews in Jesus' day was that the body will come out of the tombs. I know he'll rise in the last day. Remember John 5, 2 weeks ago. We spent so much time on that. Two resurrections. Physical resurrections. Martha's getting it. I understand about resurrections. But that's for later, Lord. That's not for today. Well, Jesus said in verse 25, I am the resurrection and the life. He who believes in me shall live, even if he dies. Everyone who lives and believes in me shall never die. Do you believe this? She said to him, yes, Lord, I have believed that you are the Christ, the Son of God, he who comes into the world. Now, brethren, I don't know. There's not enough in the verse. And I get in trouble sometimes when I point this kind of stuff out. But, brethren, it looks to me like she dodged it. I believe, what did Jesus just ask her? I think he's saying to her, I can bring Lazarus back right now. Do you believe it? And she says, yes, I do. I believe you're the Christ, the Son of God who comes into the world. Did she say anything about, yes, I believe you're going to raise my brother right now? I don't think she's going that far. Now, turn the page, brethren, and come over to John 11:32. That was Martha. Jesus is still coming. He's still getting closer to their house. In 32, when Mary came where Jesus was, she saw him and fell at his feet. She said, "Lord," exactly the same thing Martha said. "If you'd been here," that's all they get. "You can't do it now. You could have stopped him from dying, but we don't believe you could bring him back now." 37. Some of them said, "Could not this man who opened the eyes of him who was blind have what?" Three times, brethren, Martha, Mary, and everybody else is there. Is anybody thinking that he's going to raise Lazarus from that tomb 4 days dead and stinking? No! We just think he'll be saved in the resurrection. There'll be a resurrection. He was a righteous man. He'll be raised with the righteous like the Lord taught 6 chapters ago back in John 5. 39, 8. Jesus, therefore, again being deeply moved within him, came to the tomb, a cave, stone lying against it. Jesus said, "Remove the stone." And Mary and Martha said, "All right, he's going to raise Lazarus, because we believe." No, rather than what they believe is not that much. Martha, the sister of the deceased, said to him, "Lord, by this time there'll be a stench. He's been dead 4 days." She dodged the question, brethren. She's not thinking now. And Jesus said, "Did I not say to you, if you believe, you'll see the glory of God?" 43. When he said these things, he cried out with a loud voice, "Lazarus, come forth!" He who had died came forth, bound hand and foot. Hard to come forth when you're bound hand and foot with wrappings, and his face was wrapped with a cloth. Hard to see where you're going when you come forth bound like that. And Jesus said to them, "Unbind him and let him go." So, brothers, I believe it's a very fair conclusion. I think it's a necessary conclusion. We know a lot about how the Jews buried their dead. And the way they buried their dead made it absolutely impossible for you to move a toe. That body was put into this position. It was then wrapped. It was also saturated with those very gooey, sticky, you know, aloes and gums and syrups that they used to try to prevent this stench. And so, 4 days in there like that, and what do you become? You're just a cocoon. And then he said, "Unbind him." So however he came out of that tomb, he wasn't tearing, you know, the wrappings so he could walk. I think it has to be, brethren, that he was levitated out of that tomb. But now you unbind him. Now that's a miracle. Can Jesus raise the dead? Yes. Will Jesus raise the dead? Yes. Now, yes. How will Jesus raise the dead? From the tombs. He raised people from the dead while he was here, so we would understand one day he was going to raise everybody from the dead. And he himself was raised from the dead to prove it. So, that's the conclusion of our studies here this morning. What do you get out of this morning? You know all the intervening verses. What you get is, yes, he can raise people from the dead. But what are you to believe? Moses and the prophets. Because nobody's been raised from the dead for 2,000 years. This faith of ours is not based on seeing miracles. It's not based on witnessing resurrections. It's not based on our being able to step out of a boat and walk on water like Peter did briefly. But it's based on the faith in the Scriptures that empowers you to be involved in the work of the kingdom so that you plant seeds as fast as you can. And then, preaching that gospel, and you see people respond to it, No matter how foul they have been, no matter how vile of a sinner they have been, they are washed, they are cleansed. So what do? Rejoice. Like the shepherd who finds the one that was lost, like the wife who finds the coin that was lost, like the father who gets his son back. That's what matters. Now we're getting very close to Jesus going to the cross. What is Jesus really emphasizing? And note again, repetition, 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 repetition. Four times, just one time. Okay, doing that constantly. What is he hammering home? Faith in the Lord Jesus Christ. Martha, do you believe?